I certainly do hope for some connection. I don't really care about the numbers. It's not about 1,000 people need to be connected to this, but a handful of people that have, for whom the work will mean something, makes me feel less alone.
Enrique Martinez Zelaya is a Cuban-born American artist. I met him in Stockholm, and we talked about his art and his interest in literature. This is Gentleman Lars. My name is Lars Carlin. So, hello, welcome to Stockholm.
I'm very happy to be here.
I wonder, in what way have your experiences from living in Cuba, Spain, Puerto Rico, and the United States influenced your art?
You know, in many ways, that movement from country to country has influenced me, which in turn has influenced the work. But the traditional framework or narrative about exiles that often gets applied to my work, I think that have to be softened somewhat. Because a lot of the sense of loss and displacement that is found in the work has not as much to do with that migration as it does with who I am and always existed there. But to go back to your question, I think that once you become kind of nomadic in some manner, you begin to take the world in a different way, a little bit as an observer rather than a participant. So some aspect of that has been part of my work and part of my thinking.
But today, do you feel very much like an American artist, or is it very important that you're from Cuba, or is it totally a mix of everything?
I mean, I feel that I am an American artist. I think that, you know, from Cuban descent and my family life and my emotional universe in some ways depends a lot on that upbringing, Cuban, Spanish, Puerto Rican. But ultimately, I'm an American artist. It's there that I came of age. The influences and the conversation and discourse I have is mostly with American art and European art, much more than with Latin American art or Cuban art. With literature is a different story because I have a more active conversation with Latin American literature than I do with Latin American art.
What is specific with Latin American literature, according to you?
I find the literature that I discovered in my teens, what is called the Latin American boom in both poetry and novels, influential to my way of thinking and easier, more existential, more looking at the specific conditions of the way lives are lived. While a lot of the Latin American art that I sort of was surrounding me when I was growing up had a real narrative dimension that I was not so interested in. That is a generalization. There are other kinds of Latin American work that don't have those things. But in general, I just don't know enough to feel like I'm part of that dialogue. While in American and European art, familiar enough with it and have explored the questions that you have brought up, that I feel very much part of that dialogue and part of that discourse. You will see in this exhibition and all my other work, there's always the aspect of family life, home life, the past that is present. In that way, all that is Spanish, Cuban, Puerto Rican aspect of my upbringing is always there, but more personal than artistic.
How did you start to paint?
So I've always drawn and painted. By always, I mean since I was a little kid, I felt a very natural way to relate to the world. I was an apprentice for a painter in my teens, making mostly traditional paintings. But when I was going to college, I wanted to be a scientist. And that's what I studied at university. And then that's what I also did at graduate school. So I was doing a doctorate in physics when I decided that what I really wanted to do was do art. I have always done it on the side, but I never thought it would be a real career. And when I got to be in my mid-20s, I realized this is what I want to do. And then the transition from science to art took some years, and it was not easy, but I'm very happy for all of it. I'm very happy that I have that dual background. I'm very happy that I did transition when I did. I wasn't happy then, but I'm happy now about it.
Can I find anything of this knowledge of science in your art today?
I mean, I think it's there. You know, when people speak about science, for example, Alaph or Eliasson's work that is often quoted to have scientific influences or something, it looks scientific. And people think of science as something that looks scientific and of math as something that looks like geometry or arithmetic. But at a higher level, mathematics and physics look unexpectedly different than I think what people imagine. I mean, you're dealing with sort of the fabric of nature and some questions about the foundations of truth as our universe and its form. So mathematics is very elegant, and so is physics. And all of that, in some ways, that way of processing and thinking about the world, I think is in my work. But it's not obvious, because the average art person that comes to art to look for science, they want something that looks like what they imagine to be science, which typically is like high school science.
If you look at your artwork yourself, what would you say, this has influenced me because I've studied science?
Well, yeah, I mean, I look at the isolation of variables, the way I look at problems. For instance, this body of work is considering the notion of the other life. It's a life that exists in between our lives. The life that is constructed by the choices we didn't make, by the regrets we have, by memories. And in some ways, our life always exists around us. And in many ways, the way I analyze that, the way I look at what are the important factors in that life, and the way I try to be rigorous through something that resists rigor, that doesn't want to be rigorous, but still I try to be rigorous as I move through it. In many ways, that process, the associations of it, the deductions of it, the instability of reality, all those things, when I look at my work, I see them there, and all those things come from physics. Physics also has an understanding of reality that is much more complex. Things are less solid than they seem to us. And that's always in my way of looking at things. So when I talk, for example, about truth in our work, I often speak about the flickering between something being there and not being there, which is a very sort of physics way of thinking about truth, coming from quantum mechanics or something. It's not the traditional textual narrative reading that perhaps art theory brings from linguistics. It's a very different way of looking at it. So when I come to it, I never speak this way that I'm talking to you, because I always feel like it's hard to find somebody who has the overlap of background for this to be interesting. But it is the way I look at it, my work itself. And I look at the final solution of paintings as an unstable equilibrium, an equilibrium that is there but is barely there, which is also another concept from physics.
And what did your parents say when you switched from science to fine art?
As you can imagine, that was a disaster. So partly because I'm the oldest in the family, so they expected me to do something, particularly be a medical doctor. I think that's what they wanted me to do. So physics was already an odd step. And then they were worried for me. They were worried for all this effort I have done. I have done well academically, and they thought I owe myself the opportunity to do well. So yeah, it was a very difficult time, and I understood why.
But when you started with art, did it take a long time until you could make an okay living out of that?
First, I did this strange thing. I work as a scientist, and on the weekends, I sold my work in the parks of San Francisco. So I sold them in the streets. It was very unglamorous and actually quite unpleasant a lot of the time, because people just dismissed you or laugh at what you were doing and things like that. So I did this science and art combination, and I work all the time in the evenings after I came from my research job. And then one thing led to another, and I had a couple of opportunities. I was fortunate enough that I was included in some important exhibitions. And it felt very slow to me, but in retrospect, when I look at it, and when I compare it sometimes to other artists, I was lucky enough that for me it was relatively fast, but it felt painfully slow, because many of my friends were being very successful in other careers. And I was living in a flea-infested little room in Oakland, California. So it felt that I had made the wrong turn, but I still wanted to pursue it.
How many years did it take until you felt I can make a living out of the art?
I mean, I was very lucky that in 1996, which is 5 years after I made my decision to be an artist, and only 1 year after finishing my MFA, my Master of Fine Arts, I had a big show in LA that sold out, and that was pretty fast after that. So it sold out. I still probably could not make an entire living. I was lucky enough that I was hired as a professor, so I taught and exhibited. And then a few years after that, I could support myself, and that's what my parents really care about. It feels fast when I say it like this. Those 5 years leading to that were rough.
Did you learn anything from that being rough?
I learned, for instance, to be grateful now. And I never take for granted that people want my work, because I remember when nobody wanted it. I always work and I'm dedicated and never take shortcuts. And I keep in my studios the phrase, keep your actions faithful, just to make sure that the work I'm doing is faithful to that beginning. So all those lessons, I mean, I already had a lot of the lessons growing up as an immigrant about the value of work and the importance of never be too comfortable. So I think that that's the way I approach my work still today.
Were you brought up with a lot of religion?
So I was raised Catholic, but early on in my teenage years, I sort of argue against some of the teachings that I was raised with. I think I read Nietzsche too early.
How early?
I first read Tospak Zarathustra when I was 14. I read The Antichrist, which is really a study against religion, at 15. So probably understood not enough of it. Nonetheless, it changed me and affected me in some ways. Religion never felt like a comfortable framework for my questions. That being said, the questions that I'm interested in today are similar to the questions that religions engage with.
Are books still very important for you?
Yeah, they are probably the most important in terms of influences. I think much more often about literature and writers and philosophy than I do about visual arts. And I will say that I have 3/4 of my mentors are all books. A few of them have been real people, and I read constantly, and it is an important part of my life.
And I heard that you actually have read a lot of Harry Martinson. How did you even find out about him?
Accidentally, when I was maybe about 20 years ago, I found a small Martinson book in Spanish, of all things, which I read, and I was immediately taken by it. So then I began to do more research, and the other books after that I bought were all in English translation. Then I remember something I read from Joseph Brodsky about Martinson, this sort of starkness between the words, these open spaces, as well as his interest in nature and how he directed poetry towards aspects of the world that I have never seen a poet address. Very small, delicate aspects of nature that I found very tender and very firm in some way that I have not seen poetry behave before. So he has since then been an influence to me, not only in the content of the poems, not only in the subject matter, but more importantly, I think, in the way he approached poetry and the way those poems felt. I think about his poetry all the time. There's another Swedish poet that I've also discovered later, maybe like 10 years ago, Thomas Tranströmer. You know, I'd read Ekelöf, and they were important, but Martinson is a central figure for me. In fact, he formed part of this sort of a Scandinavian universe in my head. You know, like Munch, the Norwegian painter, was very influential to me. And in some ways, there is a conversation of Munch's attention to nature, Martinson's attention to nature, that I relate to. About the same time I discovered Martinson, I also discovered Hjalmar Klint, and the two of them in some ways. But something in them functions the same way for me.
And when you create your art, I mean, how do you work?
So most of my work depends on writings, my own writing. So usually when I'm studying a body of work, I write a few things, not really for the content, but rather to understand where I am and what matters to me at that time. And then those writings sort of evolved and begin to emerge. And I still try to keep it very open because I don't want to predetermine what the work is going to be. I want for it to emerge naturally from the inquiry that I'm after. And sort of midway through that process of writing and making work, I begin to really understand what the concerns are. I mean, the important thing I think to highlight about this is that I'm not really trying to express anything that I already know. The goal of the work is an inquiry, an effort to try to understand things that I don't understand. There's an aspect of unknown in the work which is not unlike what I used to do when I was a scientist. You know, you go into the lab with a lot of knowledge, but ultimately you go to the lab to resolve what you don't know. So I always go into the studio to understand what I don't know very well. So that's the goal.
Are you always trying to learn something new?
Something new about the nature of art, something new about the world as it is, and occasionally something new about myself in relationship to both those things, art and the world.
And since your art has been shown in many different countries, do you get very similar or very different reaction from people in different places?
The reaction is different, which surprises me still, because I think humans are more similar than they are different. But I think people make different connections. For example, I think in Sweden, the tendency that I have noticed is people tend to make a connection with the imagery, not necessarily with the questions of painting that are around the work, about what a painting is. So it's interesting that unusual sense that here people want to understand the stories. And what people tell you, people ask you, have you seen this artist or that artist? For example, Hill here in Sweden, it's an artist that I didn't know before, but last time I was here, people suggested I looked at him and it was very interesting. That's a discovery for me. So that's a point of entry that people have here that will be very different than they will have in Spain or London.
And do you feel sure that you will continue working with art for the rest of your life? Or could you quit sometime and do something else?
I don't know what I am without it. That being said, I'm sort of very interested in writing as well. And I see my work as part of that enterprise. So I will always do art and think of myself as an artist. The question that is harder to answer is whether I will always do art publicly. And that is a different question. I like to fantasize every couple of months that I will not do art publicly. There's the aspect of a conversation with people who make a connection with it, which is always, to me, I'm very grateful for it. But then there's the aspect of markets and that always has a friction against the work itself. It's at least a nice fantasy sometimes to be able to say, well, what if that part was detached from the work in the way an amateur painter works? And that's very interesting to think about. It probably would never happen, but I like to think about it.
But do you have any problems with the art market?
I'm gonna be grateful for it because I live because of it, or I have kids and I support them because of it. I am not a champion of the art market. I don't feel very excited about what I see with it. I don't feel very excited about the valuation of artwork in that particular way. And most of the work that I see commanding high prices and being traded and stuff is nothing that I find myself thinking about at all. So those aspects are difficult to reconcile with the work itself. Not only do I not have much faith in the markets, my sense of value about the works I respect have nothing to do with what they do in the markets, but it also, I think, it creates a lot of confusion around what the value of art is other than the monetary value of it. I think that people are standing in front of artworks in awe because they know it's worth $100 million. If you were to tell them, you know, this is worth $25, they would walk right by it. And that aura around the work is a distorting aura. It's difficult to know how to fight against it because many people try and it's not a very successful fight. But it's something that I think artists have to be conscious. And there's a lot of temptations that the market offers you as an artist, if you have any degree of success, that you have to learn to navigate and to make sure that you remember why you're doing it. Because everybody always tells themselves, oh, I'm just being realistic. What's so bad about doing 5 versions of that painting? All those stories that we tell ourselves so we can begin to lie to ourselves are often prompted by market desires.
Have you met a lot of nasty people working in the art market?
I don't know if the percentage of nasty people in the art world is any bigger than in any other environment. I mean, I was a scientist for a while and I met a bunch of nasty people in that world too. I say whenever there's a concentration of wealth and ego, both which are in the art market, you're going to get some characters in there. But I'm sure that if I was involved in the charity work in Africa, I will find some very unpleasant people here and there, but the concentration may not be as high as in some place that, you know, people in the art market are, you know, many of the collectors are people who are very successful. And sometimes with success comes, not always, but sometimes it comes a lot of arrogance. You deal with the other end of it, who have feel that they have failed or they have not done well in the art market, so then they're bitter. So you, not only do you have nastiness, you have sometimes bitterness and upsetness and depression and jealousy, and you might have a fantastic painting by Manet, but a lot of things around it are that sort of competition between jealousy, desire, manipulation, all those things. And in the middle is Manet's painting quietly, watching the whole spectacle.
Are your kids also into art?
You know, I don't think they are, although they're too young. Like my oldest is 16, I have 4 kids, and maybe it's too early to know. Sometimes these agreements with art happen later in life. And I have never pressed them in any way. I mean, they have always been around it. They have always been part of my life as a studio. I tried to keep my personal life and my work life important. So, and the way that I have done that is, so who knows what's going to happen with them and art. If one of them told me they were going to be an artist, I would be both excited and worried for him or her.
In what way would you be worried?
It's such an unlikely thing that anyone will have any degree of success in this career. If I would have known everything I know now when I make the decision, I probably would not have done it. Because when you're younger, you think of yourself as an exception. People give you the statistics and you always think you're a deception. But the reality is most of us are always the rule. The real challenge for an artist is waking up every day full of doubt. And I think we all have those doubts. A doubt, am I good enough? Is this meaningful? Do I have what it takes to make another work? Why am I doing this? It's such a fundamental questioning, which is different than when I was a physicist. When I was a physicist, I wake up in the morning, I was going to design a laser, and I don't remember ever asking, am I good enough to design a laser? But now I walk every day, I stand in front of a painting and said, am I good enough to make this? So that doubt wears you down. Many artists try to hold on to something solid. Sometimes the markets, sometimes their own bitterness. They hold on to that just because doubt is erosive.
Have you found out things that are really important for you? Is it important to have a studio or enough time or inspiration or...
Now I feel very lucky and privileged and grateful. I mean, I have a wonderful studio. I have time to do this. I get to take on the questions that are pressing, whether you and I are having a conversation that can become part of my work. When I was a scientist, I would go for 3 months thinking very, very, very hard to solve these physics problems, and yet at the same time, not having a single thought about anything related to my life because I was so consumed with thinking. My life was outside of physics. Now my life is very much part of the work. It's a meditation on the questions that matter to me, and not just to me. I think the questions that matter about how to be in the world in some manner.
So can I find anything of Los Angeles in your artwork?
My interest in, for example, in LA is the landscape and the light and the sense of immensity of that landscape against sort of human problematics and ideas, nature. And all those things are in the work, but they're being like cooked into the work. They're not so obvious. And there's no such thing as an LA has the friction of a lot of cultures at play in there that resist any idea of an LA aesthetic. And in general, I resist those simplistic things. You know, that's why I'm interested in sort of Scandinavian work or German or Spanish. I think that the human condition has manifestations in many different places, and I'm always very cautious with the idea of something that is topical or transitory or superficially like a decorative art of a certain period. I don't think art is that.
When you create your paintings, I mean, can you create some of them kind of fast? Is it pretty much the same all the time?
They all take longer than I always think that they're going to take, partly because I don't do preliminary studies. So I start in the painting with something, but sometimes they're radically different. They seem to have nothing to do with where they started. So some paintings can go for as long as 5 years. Very early on, within the first month, was almost like it is today. Then the next 6 months, I was working on all those aspects of painting that are not so obvious here to make it credible. I always dreamed that maybe I will do some fast paintings. Not yet.
Do you ever like spend a couple of months with the painting and then throw it away?
Well, I never throw them away, but I often paint them over. Sometimes I feel that a painting may be done. Doesn't happen that often, but I think it may be done. And then a few months later, I said, no, it's not done. I repaint it and do it again. I don't know what's wrong with it, but I don't feel a connection with it yet. And then I let it sit there for a couple months and I bring it out. And I have done that dance with paintings for years. But I never throw anything away. I always rework it.
Do you ever get angry when you read or hear what people say about your paintings?
Less now than I used to, but there was a time where a lot of the writers will say positive things about my work, but I never felt that that's what I was doing. I felt like they were saying something that had nothing to do with my real concerns. Now I feel that when I read things, it's closer to my investigation, it's closer to what I'm trying to do. So that makes me happy. There are things that I don't like and I fight all the time against them because they are easy narrative. For example, the narrative that I'm an exile, but when you're an exile, that becomes a real easy label. So those things are frustrating to me because it's not that they limit me, they limit the understanding of the work. A lens through which the work will be seen that tends to limit the possibilities of the work and limits the connections that the work can make with someone else. One of the things that I like to do while we're doing is the opportunity to say a few things about the work that create bridges, ways to for the work to be understood.
But to you, is it important that your artwork somehow changes the world? Or do you care if people see your art and somehow are influenced or inspired?
I certainly do hope for some connection. I don't really care about the numbers. It's not about 1,000 people need to be connected to this, but a handful of people for whom the work will mean something. It makes me feel less alone. And I have been touched and moved by other people's works, both in literary form, in music, in painting. Those works have meant a lot to me, and they mean a lot to me. So the fact that my work might mean something to someone is an honor. I feel very privileged by having contribute to somebody's life like that. People have said something that I know that means something to them. And that's maybe the biggest reward of this whole thing. But not changing the world in the sense that paintings, art does not change the world as much as art people would like to think it is. There's not a precedent historically. Somebody might read Tolstoy's War and Peace and process it, and then those people in turn influence the world a little bit, and over time, a work like that comes into the consciousness of the world and makes a change. But through a lot of people, there's not a single artwork who have transformed the world with their work. Those are the things that sometimes art people say, they're naive, I think. But that is not a benchmark either. You know, to change the world is not possible, but it's not necessarily that important anyway. I'd rather be interested in how my life was touched and changed by, for example, encountering Hilma af Klimt's work. In terms of my life, that's a big change.
What is it that you enjoyed very much with her work?
I find those paintings to be unexplainable. I don't understand how to frame them in their historical moment, even though I have read a lot about her, but they're still surprising where they emerge. When I confront those paintings, I find them to be very moving, profound, beautiful in those ways that I'm grateful that they're out there. They teach me about painting, they teach me about possibility, they create this horizon of possibility that makes me feel just a little bit more alive about being human. It makes me feel that life is more than it seems. All of that I'm grateful for.
If you could come up with one book that you think I should read, can you suggest something that's really good?
Whenever I try to think about that question, like what book will I take? If I had to take one book, I would take Moby Dick.
And why would you choose that?
You know, I think Melville in that book managed to wrestle with some fundamental questions about our place against a universe that is impassive. Ahab, you know, the captain in chase of the whale, that whale represents all that is possible and all that ultimately derails our lives. And, you know, this monomaniacal, this chase, most of us are chasing some crazy whale down, which is going to take us down eventually. So I feel like I could read it 100 times in a desert island and never exhaust the book. I think I understand the world through books.
How did you get into reading?
My parents are not big readers, but I think that what happened to me was when I was a kid, and I think we all feel these things, like the world did not make sense to me, but it seemed to make sense to other people. What I wanted to do is try to understand. I was hoping that somebody would tell me the answers, you know, in some manner. So I went to books, and that created a habit of going to books to make sense of things. My life has sort of been defined by that, from reading. And I think also reading is a great antidote to loneliness. As a kid, I found myself, you know, I played and did all those things, but I found myself lonely quite often. And I think that books were always companions. They're always ready there. You open the book and there you are in a conversation with somebody. And that was great. My life became richer because of it.
But did you feel lonely because you moved?
I'm always surprised when people imagine that moving does it. Because when I was in Cuba, before I ever moved, where I feel my sense of being different in some manner, I always had an inherent sense of the questions within me. And then those questions within me had nothing to do with having lived in another country or having left. Of course, just like anything else that happens to us, exile just exacerbated, just expanded the questions. But in some ways, whether I would have stayed forever in the same country, I think in many ways I would always been wrestling with the questions of the meaning of things. Questions tend to hover around loneliness in some manner. Exile, I think, makes very clear the things that are always present, which is that things don't last forever, that what you think is your reality is really mostly an illusion. And in some ways, those are true for everybody. And the strangeness of ourselves against the world and against ourselves is also something that exile brings forward. You become a stranger immediately in the other country. But in some ways, we're always that. Exile lifts the veil and shows you that this is the way things are. So I think it's just one of exasperating ailments that were already there.
But do you feel lonely today as well?
I have a great relationship with my children. I have many friends, a reasonably happy life. I think ultimately anybody who looks within themselves, I think finds a space there. Quite often you do feel that sense of loneliness as well as aloneness. It's not crippling. I think it's always there. It's an existential condition of being who we are. So I think it's better to distract oneself, and then you think you're not lonely, but you are, especially in modern society. I mean, when I see everybody looking at their cell phones, when they're walking around, having companionship from everywhere, to me, that is symptomatic of loneliness, of lack of being with themselves, by themselves.
Are you anything into social media or a lot into that yourself?
Well, I mean, I have, my studio has a Facebook account and an Instagram account, which they post things. So and I enjoy that. And I have made friends and connections. The studio has conversations with people around the world because of social media. So that's very, very good. And it's fantastic. And it's, yeah, certainly some form of companionship. But it also has its problems, I think. How do you manage it, you know, as part of our condition today.
Are there any things that you have been surprised about in Scandinavia? I mean, you had a cliche before the first time you came here, and was it like that, or was it very different, or?
So many of the landscape look familiar, because I have read about it, I sort of knew about the landscape. And in some ways, the landscape has some relationship with some of my paintings. I never took those stereotypes that people tend to think of in Spanish countries, for example. They describe people in Scandinavian Nordic countries as cold. But I already knew a couple of Scandinavian people, so it was easier for me to feel like dealers here were very, very warm inside, but maybe it takes slower to get to know them. So I didn't have those stereotypes coming in here. I was not that surprised by seeing people. It's a foreign country, so in many ways I don't understand and explore. And so yesterday we took a boat, we went on the archipelagos, and I was looking at that landscape. It is a very different landscape, cold ocean. It's different than anything I grew up with. But I have a connection to it through stories, but it's still foreign. So yeah, I'm here. I love the discoveries. To continue this conversation with Scandinavia for a long time. The day before, I had Harry Martinson's daughters here, and it was great to see them, to speak with them about their dad. That's amazing. Never thought that that would happen. I love being here.
The producer of this episode is Lars Carlin. Editing and mixing was done by Anjuli Kopta. Gentleman Lars is produced by the production company Tonträff.